Perhaps you received and read the little missive that I sent out this week. I've been trying to send out words of encouragement. My discipline has been a challenge to do it once a week. I haven't always met that standard, but was inspired this week. And hopefully you had the chance to be able to take in the experience of slipping and sliding on the icy incline. Maybe you have been there yourselves. And I definitely have been there, which is why I was so ready once I realized I was not going to be a participant in an accident, someone who would come out and help someone else who was obviously losing control and unable on their own to be able to make their way either up or down or off the ice. It was one of those experiences that in the vernacular of youth today, I was reminded of it again this morning. I could see as her wheels turned in front of me and spun madly and just started hydroplaning on the ice as the car itself just started to descend beyond the control of anyone at the steering wheel. She is what youth would say was cooked. Cooked. They challenged me to use that phrase in the sermon, so I have obliged them. And yet, blessed are those who are cooked sometimes, because it's there that God might be able to show up and deliver, maybe not just for the person whose brain, whose emotions, whose life is a little fried, but those who care for them might also grow. And it was that way for me, because I realized as the tires fiercely spun on the ice, it wasn't a matter of working harder. And the car, and certainly the driver, were not lazy. It was something different entirely. It needed a different set of eyes, and it needed someone to come alongside and there, sort of in relationship and as a community, find the right alignment to be able slowly to get traction and make their way again. And that's something that we as church, of course, have been reckoning with over and over again. And in my time here with Yates, I've seen it, the number of kind of inspired moments where people with great passion may lean into a ministry or seek to found a new ministry, something like, let's say, English as a second language, or the Companions Along the Way ministry, a way of growing in community through contemplation and prayer together, a slow and patient, methodical discipleship that in many ways comes alongside us in our real life and tries to locate God in the good, the bad, the ugly, and everything else. These are amazing ideas, and I don't have enough time just to list all the inspirations that have come our way as a church. And we also know that even with all the momentum that may have begun, many of these good ideas, we have also experienced the disappointment and the story that comes as people begin to set down the work, or they might drift away. And eventually there's one person holding it. And they continue to hold it because they are committed and remain infatuated or in some way really passionate about the mission that it represented. But as they stand there alone, they sometimes wonder what happened here anyway. What happened? And then collectively as a church, we've seen that happen too, that there are agreed upon mission goals or hopes or outcomes that simply have not come to pass. And we're left wondering what happened anyway. Those young adults that we baptized in this fellowship, they grow up and they leave, and they don't just leave for college, they leave for good. And we carry that grief with us. And we do it kind of quietly, because what are you supposed to say? Anyway, my kid doesn't want to come to church. Feels like a failure, even when it's not. Even when it's not. I keep turning in my own reflection, in my own, in many ways, sort of leadership charting I keep turning back to the data from those listening sessions from a couple of falls ago. And granted, we were not done any favors with really thoughtful recording of those thoughts. It takes a bit of translation and it takes a bit of focus to be able to understand maybe what was being expressed, but some of them came through loud and clear. There was one that said, my 21-year-old doesn't want to be here. That hurts. I read those words and my heart breaks. I don't know how it feels when you hear those words. And it's beyond the solidarity I might experience with someone's kind of private shame as a parent or as a family. That weight that people sort of carry alone and can't name. And we come to church and we carry the weight of those private hurts and disappointments, and that we see the space between what we hope for and what we're living out and experiencing in our daily life here and in the world. And it's nothing short of a breach. It's not a metaphor. It is a breach. It's that gap in the wall for us between what we hope for and what is. And we can only see the gap, of course. And that's where we find Isaiah today, by the way. In chapter 58, this is a prophecy, a poem, and a call issued as the word of God from the prophet as he surveys the rubble-strewn walls of Jerusalem. He saw the same thing as he circled the perimeter. The exiles had come home from Babylon by this time, and they were free. They weren't captive, but the city was not restored. The walls had gaps wide enough for you to walk through, for other people to walk through, and certainly the conquering Babylonian soldiers had done just that. And extracted a heavy price from the people. And the shame of that conquest, of that exile, did not go away. In fact, they're reminded of it every day. They viewed the breaches in the walls, or they saw the gates that were burned down and charred all the way to the posts, all the foundation stones that had been laid so long ago, lying in piles that had fallen years ago, still there. No one had rebuilt them yet. It was a little later that Nehemiah would walk those same walls at night, carrying a lamp, because he needed to see clearly what needed to be done. Nehemiah, of course, as he circles, is not there to assign blame. Nehemiah is there to determine what needed repair. That's what prophets do. They walk the perimeter. And they name the broken places, and they don't pretend everything's fine. And so that's the gift that Isaiah gave the people, and he gives us today. That gift comes as piercing as his words may be, as this. God's not asking who broke it. What the prophet asks today, and what we hear from God, is this: how shall it be repaired? And that word cuts quite deeply. Is this the fast that I choose? To bow down your head like a bulrush and lie in sackcloth and in ashes? Because God's naming another breach now, not the one that they see with their eyes. God is naming the breach that often happens in communities where there's a space between the performance of religiosity and actual faithfulness to the calling. The people were fasting, says Isaiah. They were going through all the motions, and still they were oppressing their workers. They were still quarreling on all of the holy days. They were still serving all of their own interests while claiming to be serving God. And so sometimes this gets caricatured as God rejecting worship. And that is not what's happening here. God is rejecting that version of worship that allows us in some way to feel pious while the city crumbles. And so the fast that God chooses looks different. Instead of worrying about those outward displays, Loose the bonds of injustice. Share your bread with the hungry. Bring the homeless poor in. Don't forget your kin. Clothe the naked. And then your light will break forth like dawn. That light is not the signal to begin that work. The light is the sign that it's happening. Light emerges as the repair begins. And I think some of us need to hear that, because we have been trying to generate light on our own. At the heart of that little parable that I shared about slipping on the ice, it was just that. How many times, as I looked at my own life, did I try and see a gap between what I hope for and what is, and just work harder and lose effective every step of the way? Plan better, carry more. And at the end of the day, you find yourself exhausted and alone and still in the dark. The light did not come. And the light won't come if we, as disciples, forget that part about repair. And that's what I kept hearing in those words. I told you, I do read those listening session comments more than once. And I hear it in so many ways. There's one that was crystal clear. It said, I'm tired of meeting resistance. And I get that. Some of us have tried to start new things, or some of us have tried to keep things going and feel like we're just pushing a boulder up a hill wearing flip-flops or Crocs. If you've ever tried it, don't. Because we know what needs doing. And the breach isn't there because we lack vision. And the breach isn't there because we lack motivation. The breach is that good people burn out while others stand by, not idly by. They want to help, but they don't know how to step in. And Isaiah names that brokenness, but he names it in a way that helps us to hear what could be. God names what could be. You shall be called repairers of the breach. And that's you, plural. It's the y'all version of Hebrew. Y'all will be called repairer of the breach. Y'all will be called restorer of streets to live in. Repairer, not hero, and not savior, repairer. It's not a job title as much as it is a name that God bestows upon a people. Y'all are repairer of the breach. God doesn't ask any one person to patch that city up by itself. Now we have to fast forward in time, in biblical time, to the New Testament age. And the Apostle Paul writes to Corinth. The church in Corinth is splintering under the weight of competition. People are lining up behind their favorite teacher, seeking a better brand or the best place to align themselves. They're boasting about their wisdom. They're boasting about their spiritual gifts. They're working themselves into exhaustion, trying to prove something. And Paul stops them cold. In the end, he says, when I came to you, I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. Now, Paul is brilliant. He's not being anti-intellectual here. He's not being reductionist. What he's saying is that all the eloquence in the world does not fix the fractures you have. And there's no technique that you can adopt or practice that's going to heal it. All that wisdom and all your effort, none of this is going to close the breach. My proclamation, he says, was not with plausible words of wisdom, but with a demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on the power of God. And Paul knows, I think, what we sometimes forget, that Christ crucified is God entering the breach. That God doesn't stand at a distance offering us advice. God walks into the rubble, into the space that represents our disappointment and our fear and our humiliation, and absorbs it all. All the violence, all the fracture, all of that, God takes upon God's self in Jesus on his cross and then walks out the other side carrying the keys to death and the grave itself. That's the freedom of the gospel. That you don't have to save yourself and you don't have to save the church. Christ has done the saving. Christ has taken on death and won. Your job is not to be a Messiah part two. Your job is to walk in the path that Messiah has walked. And for us, that reframes a whole lot, I think. That repair is no longer some sort of heroic individual effort on anyone's part, but instead is a part of community and mutual participation. Because we don't generate the light. When we get to work, the light shines upon us. It rises out of us, and we let it work through us. You got to go back a little in time from Paul, back to a hillside in Matthew chapter 5. And there Jesus stands on a hillside, and he looks at his disciples, a motley bunch of people, if there ever were any, you know, fishermen, tax collectors, all kinds of people who had no business working together. And Jesus says to them all, y'all are the light of the world. He doesn't say, keep working at it, you'll be light someday. And he doesn't say, you know, eventually, if you stick with it, with enough stick-to-itiveness and enough investment, you'll glow a little. He names their identity. You are the light of the world. You are. Present tense. And from that place, he then says, a city on a hill can't be hidden. So let your light shine before others, that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. And so it's not a question of whether you have the light, whether the light is around. The question is whether you're going to hide it under a bushel basket or if you're going to set it on a lampstand and let it shine and actually help somebody. Because light in that way becomes measurable. It becomes useful in the same way that a bridge only becomes useful to cross a gap when it's repaired, in good repair. You got to use it in a way that benefits others. You can't always see the light yourself, and it's certainly not there to shine a light on you, but with you and for you, you can notice what it illuminates. That neighbor who is isolated in the snowstorm, but had company because you checked on them. That young adult that did stay, because somebody took the time to sit down with them and find out what they really need and not guess and not impose something they didn't ask for. Or maybe it's that ministry that was dying when one person was struggling to carry it still, but then other people notice and share the load and it can be transformed. Every scout in this room, past and present, you know how shared work changes things. No one repairs a trail by themselves. There's always somebody who scouts ahead. There's somebody who brings the tools. There's someone who does the heavy lifting. There's someone who follows through. And that's how the church is intended to function too. That when we invest in say, young leaders, when we listen to their wisdom, when we make space for their gifts, we're not doing charity. We are repairing the breach between generations. And so our congregational practice this week, if you haven't picked up on it already, is this simple. Repair one breach. One. Just one. It may be a relational breach. Maybe a conversation you've put off or held back. I know for some people it's been years. Maybe it's something that's local. Maybe it's helping a neighbor with something they couldn't do by themselves. Maybe it's material, you know, fixing something that's been neglected for a little too long for someone else. Or maybe here at the church. You don't have to do everything. And it can be just one thing. Pick one breach. Something that you can actually participate in closing and close it. And that's how light stops being a feeling, and it becomes a fact. In 10 days, we will be at Ash Wednesday. Ash Wednesday is the beginning of Lent, and Lent always begins in the most unattractive and unappealing way. It names what's broken. And it names what's broken not to wallow in the sadness of that, but to walk into it in the way that Christ walks into brokenness, honestly, without pretense. And the whole journey of Lent as we prepare for Easter is to stop performing piety and start practicing repair. That's the fast that God chooses. It's always been the fast that God chooses. God doesn't say, figure it all out. Prove you're worthy, and then maybe I'll show up for the grand ribbon cutting of whatever the new thing is. God says, how did the reading end today? Here I am. Present tense. Already here. So in your weariness and in your longing and the grief that you may have over that young adult child who does not want to be here, or your hope that something will change, and the exhaustion of many of you leaders I know who are tired of experiencing resistance, or that hesitation that you may experience in that person who wants to help but doesn't even know where to start. God is here. And a city on a hill will never shine because it's flawless. It shines because God refuses to leave it in the dark. And so we are repairers, restorers, people who walk where Christ is walking, and we are those people who are doing the work that makes love visible as the light dawns in us. Here I am, says the Lord. And the church says, here we are. Let the repair begin.